And welcome to The Alchemical Mind. Today is a true alchemical mind, as joining me on this episode is Alex from The Natural Born Alchemist. So Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a long time in the making, right? I think we've kind of floated the idea of chatting for, I mean, at least 6 months now. I think I've been doing the show for about 6 months. So roughly around that time. So it's nice to finally get a chance to chat with you. I think of all people that I've wanted to talk to, you might be one of the more interesting ones because I think even though you and I share a lot of similar end goals, I think the way that we view things is sometimes contradictory. So it's nice to have somebody to be able to talk to and bounce ideas off of that doesn't always agree with everything. You know what I mean? That's always nice to have.
Yeah, I'm a contrarian by heart. So even if I agree with something you say, I have to disagree.
Yeah, for sure. No, I get that. I wanted to bring you on because through the magic of coincidence, there's been a lot of stuff going on in my personal life and with the show in terms of shamanism. And obviously psychedelics being a part of it all the time. And you're passionate about both of these topics. And that's why I figured I'd invite you on so we can chat a little bit. In particular, in terms of shamanic culture. I know that holds kind of a special place in your heart in terms of indigenous traditions. So why don't you just tell folks a little bit about you and how you became interested in shamanic cultures.
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it because I've always been interested in the esoteric and the occult ever since I discovered the story about the quest for the Holy Grail when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another, and I was deeply into alchemy for many years, and still am. And looking at that topic, it just actually led me to discover a few books that informed me about psychedelics. And that's how I also discovered indigenous. I always want to go to the source. So whenever I find something that I find interesting, I always try to find what is the source of it. Mm-hmm. And in this case, psychedelics, it was indigenous cultures. And as soon as I started to look into that, I became fascinated. And it also resonated with me. And I've always been a person that's been interested in the ancient past, and it's always been very romantic. And of course, some people romanticize it too much because it wasn't all great. But I like minimalism and simplicity, and I'm not that interested in the modern material way of living your life as much.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. In fact, I just recorded an episode, and I think it's the next one after this interview, actually, and in which I'm kind of finding that in my own practice, right? So obviously, psychedelics was kind of an entryway into a lot of different things, but you know, I've been studying this kind of stuff for decades now, and I feel like the more I go into like understanding how a practice works and how it evolves, the more I realize that you really don't need to have a lot of practice. It's just a matter of really feeling what works and what comes natural to you. And I know you play around quite a bit with this. You're a great lover of the Joker archetype. And I think that's actually really interesting because it kind of goes into some of the core philosophy behind things like Dzogchen and Taoist ideas. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's actually one of the more interesting aspects of something that is still found in shamanic traditions that has been lost in more dogmatic modern religion.
Yes, well, when it comes to alchemy, the Emerald Tablet, which is like the foundational text for alchemy, it's written by Hermes, so they say. And Hermes is the trickster god, so he is the Joker in a sense.
Yeah.
And the shaman is always the outcast. The trickster, the Joker, is also always the outcast. So the shaman is the outcast of the tribe or the community. People usually fear this individual, but they also have respect. And all the shamans that come from an indigenous culture that I've ever met, they've all been extremely funny and always laughing, constantly laughing. And sometimes people confuse, you know, this thing about everything's a joke with, you know, if I see like a mother and her child has cancer, I don't laugh at it like, oh, it's a joke, you know, sure, it's funny. I don't do that. So, but I also think that you can look at it with humor, but it's like a fine line, you know. And usually it's the best way to look at the joke is to look at it yourself, you know, your own role in the joke. So if I get cancer, then I can laugh about it because, you know.
right.
I wouldn't, you know, I don't want the, so that's a big difference. People often misunderstand that. But I do think you can joke about anything, but I wouldn't like, you know, like that example I mentioned, I wouldn't do that, you know, it's
sure,
a fine line.
You know, it's interesting too, right? Because people take things so seriously and so literally, right? And I don't like to talk about politics, so I just kind of want to gloss over this point. But that may be part of the reason why we have so much struggle, right? And so much dissent among people, is that nobody really cares to hear other points of view and kind of learn to either understand or integrate them into themselves. They're just kind of after whatever they believe in, on any side, right? Whether you're a lefty or a righty or whatever, it doesn't matter. And I think that's kind of interesting. And you know, you do see this in philosophical circles. So I think the way that you practice this this trickster idea is much closer to like what Gurdjieff would believe in than the trickster archetype that say like Luciferians use, right? Like the Temple of Set and those kind of people.
Well, it also makes you brave in a sense, because it's not all about if something is funny or not. That's not how I see it. It's also the fact that, like, for instance, like as an example, maybe you have an idea and maybe you have a business idea to start your own business or do something like that. Mm-hmm. Many people might not be brave enough to do it. But with this kind of trickster mentality, it's like, well, what? Nothing can really happen anyway. Who cares?
Right.
You know. You know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And that's why I mentioned the, you know, the Taoist idea of this archetype and Gurdjieff, because that's what it's about, right? It's like, don't take everything so seriously, right? Just kind of go with the flow. And in some ways, you're even kind of like tricking yourself, right? If you want to look at it as kind of an aspect of karma, you can trick your own karma into not giving you, say, some negative repercussions. Because even you don't know how you're going to act, right? And that seems, in many respects, kind of fulfilling. When I talk about this concept, I like to talk about my dog, because people love when I talk about the dog, I guess. But, you know, animals kind of live in this mentality, and you could say that, yeah, maybe they don't know any better, but just this natural state of just being and experiencing all the time. And I think ultimately what certain shamanic truths try to tell us is, hey, like, don't take life so seriously, right? Respect yourself, respect others, and just kind of enjoy the ride, right? And that's how you get this like healing factor from the practice. Of course, within shamanic cultures, oftentimes stemming from the psychedelic ceremony.
Yeah, I see it like as two lives. Like, you have this life in this physical body I have now, and then there's this bigger eternal life, and that life that I was before I was born and that I will be after I'm dead, that life in a sense is more serious, but this like avatar currently is, you know, not as important but it's like a learning curve. But like you, I also think I have two cats because of my day jobs and that I will never get a dog. It wouldn't be happy with my current way of life. But so I got cats instead because I need animals because they can take care of themselves when I'm at work. But
Sure.
my cats are, I always call them my greatest teachers. They teach me a lot about patience and being relaxed and being at peace and love also.
Yeah, for sure, right? Because there's no judgment of any kind. I think oftentimes that's what the problem is, right? You have expectations and opinions of what other people should believe in or say or think, or what you should believe or say or think. And that oftentimes gets in the way of having like a genuine direct experience, right?
Yeah, that's true. And also, because I'm both a cat and dog person, and I say I always often hear that cats are not as loving, really. Like they would abandon you if they got the chance, or it's not like a dog. But I don't have that experience with my cats. And when we've suffered tragedy, they've showed more love, because like they can sense when you're sad, and they behave differently depending on how I feel, and I'm pretty certain that they are, especially the female cat. I see her as like a, because sometimes when you talk reincarnation, you always say you go from cat to human, maybe. But I'm not sure. Sometimes I feel like she's higher than a human in a sense sometimes.
Yeah, that's funny actually, because I've said that about my dog. So I have two dogs and a cat. Generally I talk about my large female dog. I have a Great Pyrenees. And I often feel that way with her as well, because she seems so empathic and caring and very perceptive of how people are feeling, really, right? And she can always tell kind of when somebody's down a little bit, maybe like I'll hang out more with this person, right? Because they'll appreciate my company more. And so I can definitely relate. And to anyone that says that maybe cats are less friendly than dogs, you've never looked up stories of like people dying in their apartments and them being eaten by their pets afterwards, you know what I mean? So there's a fine line even there too, right? Things always follow the natural state.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking about like with children, because children are like kind of like embodying this trickster mentality, because they haven't realized they should care about things yet. Like I'm talking about when they're 3, 4 years old, and so they're completely liberated, and they usually are. I mean, like if they could make the choices that politicians have to make, they would make better choices. But I think maybe it's the rules and responsibilities and all those things that destroy it. And when you see really, really old people, they are more playful because they know that they got nothing to lose anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like you get to a point where you stop being yourself, right? And you try to conform as much as possible. There's some interesting science in terms of that. I know, you have this whole idea of the bicameral mind, which I don't buy into, but there is some interesting science about the roles of the left and right brain in terms of development psychology. And one of the ideas is, when you're a child up to say 3 or 4, you're more predominantly right-brained, and that's why children are more prone to like having imaginary friends and seeing ghosts and apparitions and other hallucinations than when you get a little bit older and your left brain begins to develop a little bit more, and you have the proper use of language, right? Whereas before it's more of an image-based method of communication between you and the brain. And I'm curious if you've ever thought about any of these kind of things, in particular in terms of psychedelic use, with something like DMT or psilocybin or anything like that.
Well, I feel that you become more like a child in that state. And I saw a lot of similarities when I had a baby, the way the baby was behaving and the way you helped the baby when it was screaming or crying. Was the same way you helped somebody in a psychedelic ceremony when they were in trouble. And also the fact that you can't, if you take a proper dose, maybe move so much and you become almost like a child. But I think I always quote this Terence McKenna quote, where he's like saying that the brain is like a folded, or the mind is like a folded blanket, and when you take psychedelics, you unfold it. I think that's a good way to describe it. But I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, that's interesting, actually. I you know, as much Terence McKenna lectures as I've listened to, the quote was not familiar, so that was kind of cool, and it's very descriptive. The issue kind of becomes sort of the thing afterwards, right? And I think that's something that McKenna is very good at explaining. Even Alan Watts and McKenna kind of seem to go at each other sometimes, not directly, obviously, but there's some words in terms of their ideology that differ quite a bit. I think that's interesting, that how to navigate the blanket maybe once you've unfolded it.
Yes, exactly. That's the hard bit, maybe.
So what would you say sets like an indigenous culture that still practices shamanic tradition with psychedelics from a spirituality that people are more familiar with? And I don't want you to include, like, say, yoga, for example. I mean, we can get into the discussion if you want, but, you know, things like yoga and meditation seem to really just have lost a lot of the beneficial aspects, just like maybe psychedelic ceremonies could begin losing some of that aspect. And I do want to kind of prod you a little bit on that, but let's go back to the first thing, how those ceremonies and those traditions differ from something people might be more familiar with.
Well, when it comes to psychedelic ceremonies, I've only done the indigenous versions. I haven't really done the more what maybe people are familiar with. Or how do maybe I misunderstood your question?
I guess. Go ahead and speak to that. Let's start there. Speak to the traditional ceremonies.
I'm sorry. Let me say, like, it's a huge topic, but there's like two camps when it comes to indigenous cultures and psychedelics and shamanism. And one camp says that indigenous shamanism with psychedelics is like debauchery, or like it's gone wrong. And another camp says that that's the only true shamanism. And the indigenous shamans who don't use psychedelics, they're like lost their way. And I'm in the camp where I'm more leaning towards that it should be with psychedelics. But it's not only psychedelics. I mean, they use all the plants for many different reasons. So it's not like the main star of their shamanism is not necessarily the psychedelic, but it's part of it, you know. I think that it's a bit ironic that I'm for the indigenous traditional way of doing psychedelics, or their way of approaching it, when I've through my whole life I've been an iconoclast against traditions, breaking traditions. Mm-hmm. I always hated traditions. And ironically, now I'm just like a traditionalist. It's really strange.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a fine line, but maybe the things that you've kind of rebelled against in the past are more what you feel are corruptions of I hate to use the word good or proper, but something more akin to that, right? Where you seem to resonate more with shamanic traditions because they seem more true and less bogged down by BS.
Yeah, they liberated me in a way. One good example is I live in the part of the world where you celebrate Christmas, and it's a Christian tradition,
of course,
of sorts, I guess. And then I had a period of my life where I banned Christmas from my life. I didn't do anything. I was against it completely, but now I return to it. But ever since I've been involved with psychedelics and shamanism, and now I've been liberated in the sense that, you know, like I remember last Christmas, I was in sitting by the Christmas tree. There was Christmas decorations, on the music was actually a recording of Krishna Das, like Hare Krishna music,
Okay,
and I was reading the Quran.
yeah.
And I was like, because like shamanism is like, it's all of it. It's not like it was before all of it. So, and you can find the golden nuggets in all religions. So it's kind of like liberating me. So like all religions is my religion. And if I read a religious text and there's something I don't like, I have the freedom to just say, well, I don't like that chapter, so I'm gonna just discard it, you know.
I definitely can agree with you on that. I also see myself as a little bit of a perennialist, and so there's always some nugget of truth to every religion and every philosophy, right? Even if you want to look at like modern cults, right? Like I just recently watched the Heaven's Gate cult on HBO, and it was fantastic, really well done, and a lot of footage I hadn't seen previously. But even a belief system like what Heaven's Gate cultivated does come from some nugget of truth, right? Even if maybe the outcome has nothing to do with the nugget of truth itself. And you can say this for any tradition in any part of the world at any point in time. And I often find myself doing something similar. I don't usually have music on when I read. But I do read from every tradition, and I pick and choose things that make sense, right? And I try to recreate, I guess, the most accurate depiction of the world in my mind based on some of the things that I read, and most importantly, have direct experience with, either through meditation or just like hanging out in the woods or doing psychedelics.
Yeah, I agree. And one great example, I think, is the Unabomber manifesto.
Oh
The
yeah.
Unabomber is normally a very hated person. He's a terrorist and he killed people and all that. But his writing is really good.
Yeah, I wonder if you gave somebody just like pieces of the manifesto, right? And you said like read this and it's some sacred text that I found in a cave, right? And you had somebody read it. I wonder like how many people would be like, yeah, that's kind of how it is, until you told them who wrote it, and then they're like, oh yeah, this is BS.
Yeah. Probably a lot of people, I think.
Yeah, that seems to be the case for many things. I like to quote out like Sufi mystics sometimes, and I get like, oh, that's beautiful. Who wrote that? And I'd be like, such and such person, and they're like, who's that? I'm like, oh, he was a Muslim mystic. They're like, oh, Muslims? Like, I don't like that anymore. I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't see why it really matters, if there's wisdom in it, there's wisdom in it. So just take it as it is. I'm curious how you feel. Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
No, sorry.
I'll say I'm curious how you feel about the way that these psychedelic ceremonies are developing all over South America in particular, in terms of the commercialization of it. I know you and I have like briefly in the past talked about psychedelic use over Twitter and things like that. But I'm curious how you feel about, I mean, I guess really the commercialization and industrialization of the ritual.
Well, I think it's important to go to the source. The thing I have the biggest problem with is that they steal from the indigenous and then they sell it in the West, and and they even sometimes call themselves shamans or whatever, but they're not. You can't be a shaman doing a 2-week course and watching some YouTube videos, you know. So it's also dangerous. I didn't pretend to be a shaman or anything, but I one time I facilitated a mushroom ceremony. I just it was in the beginning of my psychedelic career, you know. It was so amazing. You have to share it with others, you know. It's just wanted my friends to like. So there was like 7 people. They all took it, and I was kind of like responsible, it felt. And I'll never do that again. I mean, nothing really happened, but the feeling of like the responsibility of these people's like sanity was like I felt like, oh no, this is it's not, you know, I have to dedicate my life to this if I want to facilitate other people's journeys. You know, I can't just, I mean, I can be a sitter, but I can't
sure.
be like the master of ceremony or something like that.
Yeah. But I mean, being a sitter is a little different, right? It's, I mean, it's still a big responsibility, but not the same as leading a ceremony.
No.
Yeah.
No. But in the Amazon, for instance, I mean, there is commercialization, but so when you go there, you should find an indigenous like retreat, not one that's like run by white people and not like using the indigenous people at all. You know, I mean, the retreat can be run by white people, but the indigenous people have to be completely involved in in the processes and properly paid. And sometimes I hear people say like, you shouldn't pay for it. But I think, well, you pay your doctor.
Sure, right.
So I don't see a problem with that.
Yeah. I thought about that quite a bit in terms of the podcast too, right? Like, how do you support it, right? I want it to obviously be freely available, and it always would be. But also why not receive some reward? And I've played around a lot with that in terms of the commercialization of shamanic rituals in the Amazon, because you're right. Like if people are going to go there and do it anyway, and there's going to be an industry that arises out of it, why not take in the cash for it to support, the endeavor, right? And maybe support the tribe or however it works. I just saw, I think MAPS had recently shared an article. There was, I don't know if it was a Kickstarter or like something similar, some fundraising campaign for a charity that kind of supports shamanic rituals in the Amazon and supports local tribes, indigenous tribes, in kind of making sure that they don't get taken advantage of. And the campaign like failed miserably, right? And I think they got like a quarter of what they were asking for. And then, you know, the goal wasn't huge. It was $200,000. But still not, I mean, I would assume the industry is worth way more than that, right? And if people are willing to pay thousands of dollars to go to wherever and do a ceremony, I wonder if either they don't understand the thing that they're getting involved in and the circumstances surrounding, or if they just don't really care, right? And if it's the latter, that seems a little, I don't know. I mean, I guess it makes sense in terms of a Western mentality of taking advantage of local traditions throughout history, but it just doesn't sit right with me, really.
I was at the conference many years ago, and Jeremy Narby was speaking. I don't know if you know who that is, wrote The Cosmic Serpent. And he had a great talk. I have a record. I played it in one of my episodes long ago. But in it, he basically said that the indigenous called... he was an anthropologist, and he heard that they called them... The indigenous people called him like a vampire. So he started investigating, and then he realized that, well, first they came there to extract the gold, you know, to suck out the gold like mm-hmm. a vampire. Mm-hmm. And then it was like the rubber, and then it was like land and oil, and now it's ayahuasca. So it's like it's always extracting something. And white people, I mean. So he had a good thing, good advice regarding that. It says that regardless if you do psychedelics, ayahuasca, especially if you do ayahuasca with indigenous people, or if you do happen to do it with only white people in the America or somewhere, that you find like that fundraiser, for instance, or something else where you like give something back. You mm-hmm. don't only take. You. So if you have a good ceremony, maybe the next day, maybe you send $20 to some organization that is working with indigenous people or whatever. So you like send some energy back, not so you don't only take.
Yeah, and there is something about allowing the culture to continue, right? Independent of simply being a means and a resource for others. And that's particularly true in the Amazon, and especially in modern times, right? The Brazilian government is definitely very much against preserving native cultures there. And you kind of see this throughout the world, and I do wonder if maybe there is some hope for a movement towards preserving these things, right? I know that in various parts of Canada, for example, they've returned native land back to the tribes, and there is kind of a movement brewing here in the U.S. to do the same. I think it's been like mildly successful. I know that there was one tribe that like got their island back, but there's really nothing in the island anyway, right? So like, state doesn't really care. Like, yeah, here, take your land back, and I would love to see this move forward through just in all kinds of places that have like really beautiful native traditions that are at risk of extinction, right? In Africa, you still have a lot of native cultures. For now, maybe in 100 years that might be a little different as we keep, I guess, vampirizing resources. But there's beautiful traditions. I was just talking about the Sami culture, for example. For all of history, the Sami were reindeer herders, and they had this ritual with mushrooms. And now most Sami don't live a native culture anymore, right? They're living in cities, and it seems like there's always going to be like a small group that wants to continue in the native way, right? Regardless of where in the world you're talking about. But I wonder at what point do we just like lose all that stuff, right? And it becomes like meditation or yoga, where it's like pay $30 a month and come hang out like in Hot Rocks or whatever, and you lose the purpose of it, right? Like you still get something out of it, but you don't get the full benefits of the ceremony and the culture.
Yeah, the Sami people, they were actually forced by law, so they couldn't really didn't really have a
Well,
choice.
that's true, yeah.
But yeah, it's true. If you look at nature, in the natural world, the healthiest nat well the healthiest forest, whatever, is the one with the biggest diversity. So anything that's doesn't have diversity in nature usually dies out. So if you have a human race that becomes homogeneous, is that what you call it?
Yep.
It will die. So you need to have as many cultures as possible. Politically, the world is trying to create bigger and bigger countries or bigger unions of countries or whatever.
Yes.
But really, what we need is we need five times more countries. We should cut it up even more. Like it should be more, it should be more diversity, not like everybody is the same, boring,
No, you're absolutely right. And I do wonder like how some of these larger states are able to continue in that way, right? Again, I don't want to talk politics, but there is a lot of talk in the US, for example, about either breaking states up in half or doing all kinds of things. And I don't know how serious any of these things are because there's always some secessionist group somewhere in the world. But it is interesting to think about, right?
But
Good.
sorry, but in when it comes to indigenous people, like they are the best custodians of our biodiversity on this planet. I mean, areas where they have full control of their territories, they're more those areas are more healthy than like n not like parks or national parks or reserves,
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect of native cultures, right? Because you have to live by the land, right? And back then, when the traditions developed, you wouldn't have like airplanes, right? So you can't be like, oh yeah, I burnt this whole forest down. Let me just fly to this other forest and not care. And that's kind of the way that we've developed in Western society, right? You kind of pretend to care about the environment, right? So you're like, yeah, put a park in the city. But meanwhile, like, is having the park there really having any effect on your overall lifestyle? Like, okay, you have a place to walk your dog and maybe go for a jog, but what about all the other things that depend on the natural environment as well, right? we don't think about those things. And maybe as things progress more and more, in terms of climate and species extinction, etc., we maybe will start thinking more about it. I don't know. That's a tough question to answer because, people have been talking about that for, since the 1800s, I guess, when we started really destroying everything.
Yeah, I just find that is I mean, it will be impossible for me to live like an indigenous person where I'm living now in like the super one of the richest, most privileged parts of the world, with all the technology and everything. But I can still like try and emulate certain aspects of it, because there are many positive things that I've discovered visiting indigenous communities, and they are very different, but there are certain traits that are similar. And one of those traits is like, which is hard for me being a kind of a hermit, but it's like community which we don't have like at all anymore. And also this thing about family, and your family is always bigger than your own family. It's also your neighbor's family. And also this outlook that everything is alive, even rocks, and everything has like meaning. Classic example is, you say to if a child, I had a nightmare, oh, it's just a dream. It's not just a dream. It's a very important dream. So tell me more. So there's no difference between awake and asleep. It's all reality,
I think I really like what you said about culture and surrounding yourselves with people. I'm also a bit of a hermit. I generally tend to not like to be around people, but I definitely do see the value of personal connection, right? And I think maybe that's more of what we've lost, right? Because I mean, I've got hundreds of neighbors around me. I don't really talk to any of them, partially because they think I'm the crazy meditating guy down the street. But there is something about establishing like a genuine connection and being able to share ideas and thoughts and not be judged for sharing those things. So yeah, that is very important. And unfortunately, with the way that the world works, it just kind of creates an echo chamber, right? So people that believe similar things just end up gathering in one spot and avoiding those that believe differently. And that's maybe something that we really should be able to work on a little bit more, right? There's value in all viewpoints and all ideas.
Yeah, I agree. It's very important to keep an open mind.
Yeah, for sure. One final thing for you. I'm curious how you feel about the, and I, this is kind of tangentially related to this, the shamanic rituals in the Amazon, maybe, but all the studies going on right now, in particular with psilocybin, and I just read recently something about doing like a DMT pill. That kind of, I don't know, it made me feel a little odd when I first read it, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, the thing is, like, I'm a bibliophile, I like a proper book, like a big book. And one of the few materialistic things I enjoy is getting books, hardcover books. And so if I make a metaphor, the hardcover real book, like a work of art, like written by Dostoevsky or something, that's like ayahuasca ceremony. And these, like, quick pills and that, it's like a tweet. But I have to also add that I do understand it also why they have to do it, and I understand because our system is built in such a way that, I mean, this is good medicine and it will help a lot of people, but making it like an easy to swallow pill or that kind of strategy also weakens it in a sense, because this is my disagreement with MAPS, who's and also with when the those all those retreats who use ibogaine, is that there's other things in the ayahuasca and in the iboga that you lose when you it's not only the DMT, it's not only the visuals, it's the there's other things in it that are equally important. And there's even tribes in the Amazon that use ayahuasca that doesn't have DMT. They only drink the ayahuasca, and you can still have a visual experience in that. I mean, ayahuasca is ayahuasca and chacruna put together.
Right.
But if the DMT was the important ingredient, why don't they call it chacruna? They call it ayahuasca for a reason. So when you make like a, if you would make a pill of it, it wouldn't really be the important ingredient.
Yeah, and you know, I've had discussions in particular. I don't know if you're ever interacted with Sandy. She's a listener of this show and another show that I listen to. But we've talked about having like this full spectrum experience, right? Where, you know, part of the experience, and you know, when I described this to my wife, she thought I was just insane for even thinking about participating in a ceremony. But you know, describing the vomiting and maybe the crapping in your pants and you know all these other things that people generally tend to avoid, you know, taking a pill for a substance like this, sure, it gets rid of all that stuff, but a lot of the experience is in maybe the pain and suffering, and that's maybe not the correct words, but as human beings, we really do learn more from adverse interactions than from pleasant ones, right? If all you ever had was, you know, like, what's that movie, Pleasantville or Stepford Wives, if it was just everyone smiling and happy all the time, it would, you wouldn't learn anything and you wouldn't understand anything, right? You would just live in this weird, blissful state. And that might sound nice, but again, it's like you said, it's like reading a nice hardcover and just sending out a tweet, right?
Yeah, I like what you brought up at that point. It's the final thing I would like to say that what they in ayahuasca, you call it the purge. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be crying, puking, or diarrhea, or whatever. Never trust a fart is a good slogan. But I think that... if people who want to avoid that, they don't understand that that's the highlight of the evening.
Right.
Like I've had many ayahuasca ceremonies. I think there's only one time when I didn't vomit, and the next day I felt like a failure. I mean, I was so disappointed. So, and I don't like vomiting. In fact, I haven't drank any alcohol for many, many, many years. And the main reason I don't drink alcohol is because I hate vomiting, and I, if you get too drunk, you know, I don't want to vomit. So mm-hmm. even I enjoy, and it's not the same as vomiting in your normal state, you know.
Yes.
It's a different kind of vomiting, and it's amazing. I mean, sometimes I've vomited out like pain and suffering from my own past that's become I vomited it out. I've seen it come out, like, and when you see like something from your past that was painful, when you actually vomit it out and you see it leave you, then you're free from that pain. I mean,
yeah.
It's like amazing. So I, and in fact, ayahuasca is called the purge, la purge. So it's, I mean, I to avoid that, I think would be a bad. Mistake. I mean, I think that's what that's the good thing.
yeah. No, I totally agree with you. This actually came up because I created this brew, and as part of the brew to help with some of the nausea, I added garlic to it. And somebody's like, why is there garlic in here? It tastes like crap. And I explained, and that's how the discussion came around as to the purging aspect of an experience. So. I still do partake of this brew. I no longer add garlic to it, and it's fine. It's fine. The purge experience can be difficult, but that's part of the process, right? You overcome difficulty, and you get to the next level, and that's really why people partake of the medicine, right? To overcome some kind of trauma a lot of times, or to learn more about themselves.
Yeah, and you, in fact, the diarrhea thing, I never had. I never shat my pants because it's very simple to avoid that. It's just that you fast the day
Yes.
and you make sure you're empty and you don't have to worry about it. But whatever you do, you will always purge. And even the shamans I met, they've said that, which you often do a lot, yawning is also a purge. You can yawn. Like I remember one ceremony, I was yawning the whole evening. Like it was also a purge. But purging on the ayahuasca is a joy compared to purging on iboga, because the substance iboga is not like a drink. It's like almost tastes like what do you call it? When you take wood and you sawdust, sorry,
Oh,
sawdust.
sawdust. Okay.
It's kind of like sawdust when you eat it. So when you vomit that, it's like vomiting sand.
Oh, wow.
That's probably the roughest vomit I ever had. But it was also amazing. Like afterwards, I felt like a god. So I mean, like I'm not complaining.
Man. That's very good. Let's wrap it up here, Alex. I want to thank you for your time. We should do this more often, man. I always have a good time talking to you, even on Twitter, and I don't know why we haven't done this yet. So let's not wait 6 more months to do it again. But tell people about your show and where they can find it.
Well, it's just called Natural Born Alchemist. If you Google that, you should find it. Also, I've started recently a YouTube channel. Just Google Natural Born Alchemist, and on social media, it's usually Born Alchemist or Natural Born Alchemist. So, if you Google that, you find it. And the website is naturalbornalchemist.com.
And that, of course, wraps up this episode of The Alchemical Mind. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again to Alex for coming on the show. And, of course, be sure to check me out on Twitter, at MindAlchemical. You can email Martin at thealchemicalmind.com. Check out the Patreon, patreon.com/thealchemicalmind, where you can support the show for $1 a month or higher if you'd like. And go to the website, check out the Discord, and all the other great things. Thank you for listening. And as always, remember that you are it.